Welcome back to the Durr Show. When I sit at my dining table, morning at breakfast, I look out and what I see is the splendid building of the United Nations. It's right outside my window, and on my daily walks, I pass it pretty much every day. I've been inside the UN building many times from the time I was 10 years old or so. I belong to a group supporting the United Nations. I worked for Arthur Goldberg, who was the United States representative to the United Nations. I was his law clerk when he was on the Supreme Court. And then when he worked on Resolution 242 of the Security Council, which was essentially the peace treaty between Israel, Egypt, and Jordan at the end of the Six-Day War, I helped draft Resolution 242. So I've always had a kind of fondness in my heart toward the United Nations, and I love its building. It's just a beautiful building. Whether or not it's true or mythological that the sides of the building are made out of stones that were originally intended for use to bury Americans if we had to invade the Japanese islands, whether that's true, exaggerated myth, doesn't matter. They're quite beautiful and spectacular, and it's inspiring when you walk by every day, because what the United Nations stands for is something wonderful. Let's remember where the term comes from. The United Nations was the group, England, the United States, that fought against Nazis. We were the United Nations. They were the Axis. And then after the victory, obviously, Eleanor Roosevelt and others helped set up the United Nations. Initially, it was out in Long Island, and it moved to its present location in New York, with land contributed by philanthropists, etc. But what President Zelensky said yesterday really got me to rethinking. I've been thinking about this a long time, but rethinking whether the United Nations really has succeeded, failed, been irrelevant. This is a good time to kind of reassess the role of the United Nations in keeping a world, or restoring a world peace. Zelensky spoke to the Security Council and he issued a challenge. He said, if you're just a debate society, shut it down. Nobody is going to be helped by debates, by condemnations, by resolutions. What are you good for? Obviously, the Security Council was set up based on a compromise. You could not get Russia and China, particularly in those days, China, to join the United Nations, to join the Security Council, unless you gave the great powers a veto. And Russia and the United States and China have vetoes. The United States has used its veto. Russia has used its veto. China has used its veto. We now know that any attempt to use the Security Council, which is the only mechanism of the UN that can actually enforce the law, it has the imprimatur of law, as distinguished from the General Assembly, where just one country, one vote. You have tiny little islands with 500 people in the South Pacific that have a seat in the United Nations, and that's a good thing, but they have the same amount of voting power in the General Assembly as the United States, Russia, and China. So the General Assembly is generally a debate society. Every year, traffic is slowed down. I can't get anywhere because I live near the UN. As heads of state come and speak, and I've been inside that that UN General Assembly when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken, when the head of the Palestinian Authority has spoken, when others have spoken. I was in Geneva when the United Nations Human Rights Council, the most misnamed organization in the world, Human Wrongs Council would be the better way to describe them, invited as their guest of honor Ahmadinejad. Remember him? The clown, the fool, the bigot, the anti-Semite who headed Iran 10 years ago or so. And I was invited to speak against him, not by this United Nations, but by a group, the United Nations Watch, which is an NGO which oversees and supervises and without any power, issues reports on the actions of the United Nations. And so I've been inside every aspect of the UN. Of course, I've been inside the United States Embassy to the United Nations when I worked for Justice Goldberg and helped him with his Resolution 242. I'll never forget a phone call that Justice Goldberg made and invited me to listen in. He put it on speaker to Waldheim, the head of Austria at a time, when he was making viciously anti-Semitic statements, and Goldberg wanted me to hear what he had to say to Waldheim, and he really put it to him quite directly. So I have a lot of familiarity with the United Nations. I once belonged to the United Nations Association and maybe even paid some dues and had a membership card. But Zelensky got me to think again. I've been thinking about it, but think again. Is the United Nations worth its salt? It's very expensive. Every single country in the United Nations, which is virtually every country in the world, has a consulate in New York, a building, a delegation to the UN, assistants, people who work there. The building itself is only a building for the Secretariat, and I live just down the block from where the Secretary General of the UN lives as well. And there have been some great Secretary Generals of the UN, and many of them have complained about the biases of the UN and the incompetence and impotence of the UN in trying to resolve real disputes, head off wars, prevent wars, and stop wars. Look, since the UN was established, there has been some great progress, and many wars have been stopped. The Dayton Accords, the Good Friday Accords for in Northern Ireland, the peace between Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. But almost none of them have been done through the United Nations. Generally, they've been done unilaterally, bilaterally, or multilaterally. Multilaterally, many nations have been involved in some of these things. I was close to some of these resolutions, particularly the ones in the Middle East, the Abraham Accords that were recently signed between several countries in the Middle East, the Camp David Accords, which Egypt made peace with Israel. I was very close to some of the people who were at that Camp David session, where I think it was President Carter got the Nobel Peace Prize for convening the session, even though basically he didn't have that much to do with the ultimate agreement. It was hammered out between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. So the question is, what good has the UN done and what bad has it done? Let me start with the bad. It's done a lot of bad. It has been a megaphone for some of the worst hatred and bigotry in the world. It has invited Yasser Arafat to speak with a gun in his holster and a peace offering on the other hand. But the gun, he brought a gun into the General Assembly of the United Nations. Arafat, he also won the Nobel Peace Prize. Probably was planning a terrorist attack as he went to Stockholm to accept it. And so, as I said, Ahmadinejad, one of the most horrible dictators and bigots in the world, is invited as a guest of honor at the United Nations Council on Human Rights. That and other factors led the United States to leave the Council on Human Rights. Israel left the Council on Human Rights. Under the Biden regime, they've gone back. The United States has gone back and basically said on a trial basis, let's wait and see. Let's see what's happening. Maybe we can persuade them to stop doing what they're doing. The Council on Human Rights has condemned Israel, one little country with 8 million or so people, one tiny little country, a speck on the map of the world, condemned Israel more than all the other countries in the world combined. The Council on Human Rights has only one agenda item, which is permanent. No, it's not Russia. No, it's not China and the Uyghurs. No, it's not Cuba. No, it's not Belarus. No, it's not Iran. No, it's not any of the countries that specialize in violating human rights. The only agenda item that's permanent, there's a permanent rapporteur, a man with a horrible history of anti-Semitism and bigotry. Only Israel is the country singled out by the Council on Human Rights for special condemnation. Every single year, they issue a report. One, Israel. Two, Israel. Three, Israel. Four, Israel. Five, Israel. I can go on 10, 20, 30. And then they'll have a little statement about what's going on in Myanmar or what's going on in an island in the South Pacific or what's going on in any of these other places. But they rarely, if ever, condemn Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, any of the great perpetrators of human rights violations. So we know they've done a lot of bad. They've been a megaphone for hatred, and they've helped legitimate hatred around the world. And, you know, when you try to debate the Middle East issue on universities, for example, as I have in Holland and England and France, other places, the first question is, but the UN condemned Israel. The Council on Human Rights condemned Israel. Israel must be wrong. They didn't condemn the Palestinians. They didn't condemn Iran. They didn't condemn Egypt. They didn't condemn Jordan. They didn't condemn Qatar. They didn't condemn any of those. Only Israel. So Israel must be wrong. If they've been condemned so many times, there's no defense. And that's clearly the way in which the UN has been perceived by many people who ought to know better. Has it done good? Yeah, it's done some good in some small areas where it's managed through the good offices of the Secretary General and maybe other parts of the UN to help facilitate bringing about peace. But if you balance, on the one hand, on the other hand, if you balance and try to calibrate the good it's done and the bad it's done, Zelensky has a point. Would the world be better off without the United Nations? The symbol is important, the symbol of the nations in the world all getting together, even for a debate society. And there aren't debates. If you've ever been to the General Assembly, the most boring. Occasionally you get a stimulating speaker like Netanyahu, or you know, American secretaries of state and American presidents have given some good speeches. British have as well. Occasionally you get a good speech. Mostly it's just people get up there and they read texts that have been written not by them or by their offices, but by the foreign ministries or the tyrants in the countries they represent. They've also set up a court system, the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice is not international. It's not a real court. And it wouldn't know justice if it fell over it. It's a sham, the International Court of Justice. Why is it not international? It excludes many countries in the world from membership on it. Again, Israel. Rarely has a judge sitting on it on a temporary basis, I think never on a permanent basis. It's not a court because the judges don't render independent decisions. They get their orders from their governments how to vote. And justice, it wouldn't know justice if it fell over it because it's specialized in coming down with decisions that are unjust, again, especially with regard to Israel. A challenge was made to Israel's security barrier. There's a barrier between the West Bank and substantial parts of Israel. Most of the barrier is an electronic fence. Some of the barrier is walls. And the International Court of Justice, rendered a decision, never mentioning terrorism, never mentioning the reasons why the wall was built, just condemning it as a property grab. And the decision was written by a judge from a country that has numerous security walls separating itself and protecting its borders. Not a word about their walls, but if it's an Israeli wall, it must be wrong. If it's a wall from another country, it must be right. So the International Court of Justice has been a bad part of the United Nations. What about the International Criminal Court? It's been pretty good. Why has it been pretty good? Because it wasn't set up by the United Nations. It's outside of the United Nations. The International Criminal Court was established multilaterally outside of the United Nations by a treaty called the Rome Treaty. The United States has not signed the Rome Treaty. And other countries have not signed the Rome Treaty. Russia didn't sign the Rome Treaty. Ukraine is not part of the International Criminal Court, though it's applying and has a certain intermediate status. But the reason that has any credibility is the judges there are real judges. They don't have to call up their home governments to tell them how to vote. Some of them do, obviously. You're not going to be a Chinese judge or a Russian judge, although neither of them is in the court. But you're not going to be a judge from a tyrannical country and be independent. So, but there are many judges that are independent. And but there are certain things it can only do with the approval of the Security Council. For example, declare an invasion to be a war crime, a crime of waging war. That can only be done by a vote of the Security Council, which has a veto by Russia, obviously, against non-member states such as Russia. So it also has limited benefit, but of all the international organizations, it is the least worst. The others, International Court of Justice, I'd abolish it in a second. The world would be no poorer for it, probably would be better for it. The UN itself, I think reasonable people could agree or disagree. Could you ever have an international body which didn't have veto power? Would any country, would the United States subscribe to an international organization that could compel it to do things without it having the right to say no or to veto it? I don't know. What do you think? Would you vote for admission to such an organization, the League of Nations, in the period between the First and Second World Wars failed? The United States, again, was not a member because it didn't want to be dictated to as to what it could do and what it could not do. It didn't want to give up its sovereignty. After all, the people who vote against the United States aren't citizens of the United States. And, you know, if there's no taxation without representation, how do you get people from one country voting to hold another country to standards without the consent of the other country? So there are lots and lots of problems about international organizations. Ukraine has really challenged the UN. The vast, vast majority of countries in the world support Ukraine and oppose Russia. Not all. There are some countries sitting on the fence. India is probably the most prominent among them. And some countries somewhat supportive of Putin. Obviously, Belarus is just a puppet regime of Russia. But some of the very extremist right-wing regimes in Europe, Hungary, predominant among them, their leaders have good relations with Putin and don't want to condemn. Israel's in a very, very difficult position. Its people overwhelmingly support Ukraine, but Russia has a presence on the Syrian border. And Israel is within rifle fire of Russian troops. I actually was on the Golan Heights a couple of years ago and could see the presence of Russian military, or I call them advisors, but they're really soldiers helping Iran. And Russia and Israel have created a no-fly zone of sorts over Syria. So Israel can't afford to be on the forefront of the campaign against Putin. On the other hand, its foreign minister has condemned Putin and supported Ukraine. Its people do that. It has sent more medical assistance per capita than any country in the world to help Ukrainians, and it has absorbed many Ukrainians into Israel, Jewish under the law of return, but non-Jewish as well. And of course, under the law of return, a very high percentage of the people who come back under the law of return are not Jewish. Their grandfather was Jewish, or their wife's uncle was Jewish. There's some relationship to something Jewish, but they're not Jewish. In fact, largely growing church in Israel is the Russian Orthodox Church, because so many of the people who came from Russia, from Ukraine, from other places, are practicing Christians, but they come in under the law of return because the law of return defines a Jew the way Hitler defined a Jew, because it was written in response to Hitler. If you're going to kill a Catholic priest who has been for two generations a practicing Christian, but whose paternal grandfather was Jewish on one side of the family, if you're going to kill them because they're Jewish, then Israel says, all right, then you're Jewish from our point of view, too. We respond to the threats. If you kill us because we're Jewish, we'll define Jew so as to be able to save you from being killed because you're a Jew. That's the reason the law of return operates the way it does. But the United Nations, if we had a vote today, a plebiscite — we don't have plebiscites in the United States. We have city and statewide plebiscites, but we don't have national plebiscites. We do, they're called the presidential election, but they're not literally plebiscites. We never vote in the United States on should we join the UN. Should we sign the treaty with Iran? That would be defeated 90% to 10%. But we don't have plebiscites. But if we had a plebiscite, I don't know how it would come out on the UN. A lot of people who don't know anything about the UN say, oh my God, what a pretty building, nice. The Secretary General's a great guy. A lot of other Secretary Generals, Trigg V. Lee, and you know, some terrific people have been Secretary Generals of the UN. So it would get some support, it would get some opposition. I'm curious, I don't know if there's ever been a poll about what Americans think of the United Nations. It would probably vary over time with what the United Nations, what have you done for us lately? So I don't know the answer to that question. But look, debate societies are important. It's important to have every point of view expressed. And that's why on the Durst Show, there is no censorship. I cannot believe the mail I get on Ukraine. I just cannot believe the mail I get on Ukraine. I had no idea how absurd some of my viewers and listeners are. And my wife said, don't call your listeners absurd. I'm very direct and very honest. You're absurd. Many of you write terrific letters, and probably the vast majority of you don't go online and do the comments. I wish you did. And so maybe the comments reflect the worst, the most extreme, the most paranoid, the most conspiratorial, but you would not believe the stuff that I get. Thank God for free speech. I mean, I think the letters I get is the best argument against censorship. I don't want to censor this stuff. I want to read it to let people judge these folks on their merits and demerits. Okay, here's one. Putin is standing up against the New World Order. It's Zelensky who needs to be arrested, tried, and fried. Okay, let's kill Zelensky because Putin is the right guy. I mean, you know, I must have gotten 100 emails along those lines. Okay, Putin tried for what? For stopping genocide? For dismantling 20 bioweapon labs? Right, I'm sure there are bioweapon labs in Ukraine, right, in your nightmares. Destroying the Nazi regiments in the Ukrainian army? Taking down the illegitimate Zelensky puppet regime? He won overwhelmingly, despite the fact that he's Jewish and there's rampant anti-Semitism still in parts of Ukraine. Standing against the global deep state. I have a few letters accusing me of being part of the global deep state. I don't even know what it is. This guy, Putin, should be getting the Planetary Medal of Awesome. Really? Okay. And they attach their names to this stuff. Andy Man. All right, this is Les 537. Get back to me after we hang Putin, Trudeau, Macron, Bush, Clinton, Obama, and a few others. I mean, this is an American? This is a part of the Western world who wants to hang our leaders and glorify a dictator. Okay. And then another lesson about Putin. This is from an American named Susie Q12345. Just wish Putin would take out DC. What is she wishing for? She wants the bodies of American civilians, children, women, to be strewn on the streets, having been tortured and raped in the District of Columbia? Shame on you. Okay. Here's one that doubts anything bad is going on in Ukraine. Forensics don't add up. April 1st to 3rd, everything good. Nonsense. We don't know what was going on April 1st and 3rd. The occupation was still occurring in many of these areas. April 1st and 3rd, everything good. April 4th, the massacre? So Russians murdered 300 people between midnight and 8 a.m. and dug a mass grave all in 8 hours. They had weeks in which they occupied some of these towns. Many of these people have been dead for days before April. Ballistics, bullets, shell casings, U.S.-made or Russian-made? Yeah, there are shell casings. I've seen them, and they are Russian-made. Why do you write these lies? Why do you insist on seeing America in the worst possible light and tyrants of Russia in the best possible light? No pools of blood with any of the bodies like they would drop there. Yeah, you've seen the fact that there is blood around them. There's blood coming from the head. First of all, there's not a lot of blood in the head. So when you're shot in the stomach, there's a lot of blood. When you're shot in the head, there's not a lot of blood. Bodies covered in mass graves. No autopsies. Yeah, there have been autopsies, and they're continuing to have autopsies. Now the Russians are burning the bodies in portable crematorium. You'll probably say, no, those are the Ukrainians who are really doing it. They're dressed up as Russians, you know, and probably Putin is really Zelensky, and he's just dressed up as Putin. Yeah, we'll believe you. No manner or cause of death. And Ukraine is crawling with reporters. Looks like they were told to stay away. What a crock. Yeah, I agree. What a crock. But I would point it at you, not at anyone else. Okay. So I talked about trying Putin in absentia. Here is the brilliant response. Can a pedophile accused by Victoria Roberts be tried in absentia? That's the answer I'd like to know. Well, let me give you the answer. Right after I was accused, I wrote an op-ed in the New York, in the Wall Street Journal. I said, please put me on trial. I'll show up. I will submit to the jurisdiction of the court. I will waive any procedural protections, Fifth Amendment, privilege against self-incrimination, double jeopardy, statute of limitations. I want a trial. I want to be tried for the crime that I was accused of committing by this woman who I never met, never heard of. And I urge the FBI to investigate, and I urge the Justice Department, if they had any evidence, to indict. I'm happy to stand trial. You don't have to try me in absentia. I was never on Jeffrey Epstein's island except before anybody was on with women or anything. I was there with my wife and my daughter and a professor from Harvard. We spent one night there. There were no young people on the island. It was years before there were any accusations or allegations. Many prominent scientists and others went to conferences there. I was never on the Lolita Express, and that's proved by the manifests of the airplanes. But, you know, it's just like the Ukraine. You don't like me, so you have to assume I must be guilty of something that I never met anybody. And I've been trying to depose this woman for years, and she's been trying to evade it for years. And I immediately submitted to a deposition. I volunteered to be deposed under oath. I waived the statute of limitations for criminal charges. I did everything that anybody would do if they were absolutely innocent. I stated from the first day, no pictures, no witnesses, nothing. How did I know that? I had to know that because it didn't happen. If it didn't happen, there couldn't be pictures, and there couldn't be witnesses, and there couldn't be corroborating evidence. If a person is guilty, they don't say that because they don't know what the evidence might be. So enough. What do you have to do to prove your innocence in this society? Submit yourself to a trial, not in absentia. I'm happy to be put on trial. Okay. Let's see. Do we have any more? Do we have any live questions?
Yeah, a lot like the ones that you're reading now.
How do you explain this? I mean, there are some others, obviously, too. Here's one. Question for Mr. Dershowitz. Thank you for taking the time to make these videos. A great public service is much needed time. I have a question. If the United States or other Western governments are forcing COVID vaccines or any other experimental procedures, is this prosecutable by the Nuremberg Convention and the Helsinki Declaration? I've taken biomedical ethics classes, etc., for undergraduate education. My father is a part ethnic Russian Jew, and I worked in... let me be very clear. I wrote a book called The Case for Vaccine Mandates, in which I said, as an absolute last resort, if there were evidence that a vaccine could help prevent the spread of a lethal disease, the Constitution, based on a decision in 1905, would probably permit compelled vaccinations for people who didn't have medical reasons or religious reasons for not taking it. We're not there. The vast, I can say vast another 25 times, of Americans are lining up to get vaccines. I'm trying to get one, and I can't get it. I can't get a reservation. They're busy and packed. The vast majority of people around the world want vaccines. So far in the United States, no one has been compelled to take a vaccine. Sure, if you don't take it, you can be fired from certain jobs in which you're in close contact with individuals. I'm not so sure I favor that necessarily, but there's no violation of the Nuremberg laws as the result of that. In any event, it's not experimentation. This has been peer-reviewed. Proof has been overwhelming that it reduces mortality and hospitalization and serious consequences. The proof on whether or not it helps prevent the spread of the disease is not so clear. There's debate about the fourth shot, the second booster. If it only lasts 4 to 8 weeks, how do you balance that against the risk? This is a work in progress. The people are well-intentioned. Everybody's trying to stem the disease. Now, of course, my listeners and my viewers, many of them have said in previous emails, what COVID? There's no such thing as COVID. It's a plot. It's part of the deep state. Some people blame it on China. Some people blame it on, if they're Democrats, they blame it on Trump. If they're Republicans, they blame it on Biden. But it's not true. It doesn't exist. It's a fake. It's a Potemkin village, you know, with that was where they build beautiful villages that didn't have any insides, just nice outside. But the evidence is there. There are some very close issues. If you want to read both sides of it, read my book on the case for vaccine mandates. You'll see I present all sides. The same publisher who published my book, The Case for Vaccine Mandates, at the same time, the same day, published a book called The Case Against Vaccine Mandates. Read that too. The author of that book has debated me, I think twice, and we've had reasonable debates. I debated Bobby Kennedy. It was banned from YouTube. My part wasn't banned. His part was banned. But I said, if his part doesn't go on, I don't want my part to go on. I believe in the marketplace of ideas. I believe in the open exchange of views. I do not believe in censorship, which is why I'm on Rumble, which is why I read these absurd, absurd emails. You know, improve your game. People who are opposed to my views, be better, be smarter, be less transparently bigoted and obvious, and maybe some people will actually listen to you. Nobody reading these letters is going to change their mind based on them. It may reinforce their silo views, but that's the tragedy of America. We live in a silo. The tragedy, which I am hoping to address by this show, is the left is wrong, the hard left. The right, the hard right, is wrong. Extremism is bad. Barry Goldwater was wrong when he said extremism in the name of justice is a virtue. No, now the left is saying that. You know, we're on the right side of racial equality, therefore we should ban speech. We're on the right side of racial equality, therefore we should ban due process. No. I'm anti-extreme. I'm anti-extreme left. I'm anti-extreme right. You can call me a puppet of the left. You can say I'm part of Donald Trump's group. You can say any of those things. I'm my own person. Everything I say, everything I write 3 or 4 op-eds a week. I do this 3 days a week. I do locals 7 days a week. Everything I say and I write comes from up here. You may not like it, but I'm nobody's puppet. I don't vote automatically for anybody. I don't support automatically anybody. I consider every argument and every view on its merits. On the one hand and on the other hand, I believe in that. I believe that every argument ought to satisfy the shoe on the other foot test. Make that argument in favor of a view you oppose and see if it still stands up. If it doesn't pass that test, it's not an argument worthy of consideration. Emerson was wrong when he said consistency, he said a foolish consistency, is the hobgoblin of small minds. Consistency and principle are important constraints on extremism. So I'm going to stick to my principles. I'm going to stick to my arguments against extremism. I'm going to read your letters and rebut them and hope to get more and better letters. Thanks. See you next week.